I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's launch of the LSE Women in Business Public Lecture Series. I'm Jonathan Booth. I'm Assistant Professor in Organizational Behavior, Human Resource Management in the Department of Management at LSE. I'm delighted to be hosting tonight's event. It's a great honor to welcome Catherine and Sue to the LSE. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
So Catherine and Sue are two inspirational women who have carved out successful careers in male-dominated industries, media, and advertising. Catherine is chief executive of Pearl & Dean. She is a member of the government expert group on body confidence, was one of the first women to work in display advertising at the Daily Telegraph. Sue is senior strategy officer at Mediacom. When she joined the company in 1990, she was the first, well, was the most senior woman they had ever employed. There are countless experiences and many challenges that they've had in business and in the career have led them to actually write this book that they're going to be discussing, The Glass Wall, Success Strategies for Women at Work and Businesses That Mean Business. Let me tell you a little bit about tonight's lecture. Tonight, Catherine and Sue will reflect on some of the differences between men and women that are stoking divisions in the workplace and provide some practical strategies that will enable both individuals and organizations to use these differences to their advantage. Now, you may be wondering why a man is standing here at the podium, right? Okay, why do you think I might be standing here? Well, I think it's deliberate, okay? To overcome these challenges that we have in business, we need to hear from all voices, okay? That includes men and women, right? And, you know, this lecture series will actually touch on issues of equality, diversity, and being inclusive more so broadly. So we will be discussing topics, for example, of paternal leave for men in the workplace, other issues such as LGBTQ, okay, and their voices. So we are going to take a broad perspective, a broad lens to these topics. Also, this lecture series is celebrating 10 years of the Department of Management, okay? And what we hope is through this series, we will actually expand knowledge for the next 10 years, okay, that we will actually have a clear and authoritative voice that advocates a fair and inclusive workplace. Okay. Now, we will be hosting a number of lectures throughout the year, so follow us on Twitter at LSE Management, that's again, at LSE Management, to keep informed of the upcoming events. Now, before we get started, I'd like to do some housekeeping, okay? So the format of the events tonight, you will have an opportunity to put your questions to Sue and Catherine, okay, at the end of their talk, giving you an opportunity to contribute to the discussion, after which you will be invited to drinks outside in the reception hall. Also, I'd like to let you know that their book is on sale outside the lecture hall, and they'll be here to sign after the talk in the Q&A session, okay? Those of you who wish to take this discussion online, I ask you to use the Twitter hashtag for today's event, and that's hashtag LSEWomenIn. And I believe it's posted here. And I think that's it. I welcome you to the stage.
Thank you very much. Very much.
Good evening.
Thank you all for giving up your late night shopping to come and listen to us witter on about our favourite subject.
This is us and this is our book. We are not on a submarine.
However, this is Sue's very favourite photograph because she's taller than me. And she never lets me forget it. So she put this slide together so she looks taller than me. This is taken by someone
called... I am not in real life.
Obviously she's not in real life, but I like her to have her moment. These photographs are taken by a chap called Colin Stout, who is the photographer of a magazine called Campaign, which is the kind of industry bible full of gossip, etc., and what have you, in our world. And Colin Stout never takes a photograph of anybody looking vaguely comfortable or anything like their mother would ever recognise them. So I look like I'm in some kind of hideous gymnastic pose, clinging on. And Sue looks like she's put her arm around me to comfort me for the fact that that I may never recover from being in this very strange pose. It's very weird. But anyway, that's Colin Stout for you. If he ever offers to take your photograph, immediately say no and substitute something that maybe you took yourself. It's my top tip. If you walk away with nothing else, that's the thing we've given you this evening.
This is part of the reason why we wrote the book, The Glass Wall, Success Strategies for Women at Work and Businesses That Need Business. So as you will know, I'm sure, about this time last year, well, slightly earlier, October 2015, the Davis Report came out to wide acclaim, saying, yay, we have beaten our target, said Lord Davis, author of the report, who used to work in banking, middle-aged man, used to work in banking. We've achieved our target of 25% of the FTSE 100 boards being women. Great, he said, we've reached 26%. So apart from point one, which is that the population of this country, tell me again, Catherine?
I think the 51% will be the women.
So well done us having a 25% target in the first place. When you dug into the statistics inside the report, what you discovered very easily is that most of the 26% were not executive women. So most of them are non-executive directors. I'm sure they are very, very good at their jobs, but a NED gets paid to turn up four or five times a year, sit for half a day, I'm sure makes a great contribution to that board, but that is not executive women directors coming through as a pipeline. And the number of executive women directors on FTSE 100 boards, the proportion, is actually 9.6%, less to celebrate.
In fact, there are actually more men called, I think it's David, leading FTSE companies than there are, in fact, women leading companies. And I wouldn't mind, but David isn't even that popular a name, for heaven's sake, so just bizarre. 28 trillion is the loss that we have to the economy by women not playing a role actively. So imagine what we could do if we got women being properly active in the workplace, taking their role, playing their part, just the difference that would make to us. And not only, it's not just about the money, it's about the personal satisfaction, it's about the balance that would bring, and the fact that it increases profits for companies as well when you have a mixed board.
Statistic after statistic shows that boards with mixed gender are more profitable. So 28 trillion is a very big number. A number that I can slightly get to better grips with is the number in the Grant Thornton research that came out earlier this year that said that if the difference between mixed gender boards on listed companies in the UK, US and India, those boards that are mixed gender are $655 billion more profitable than men-only boards. There is research after research, study after study, that says that it is better for business to have more diversity at decision-making levels. This is not a, as Jonathan said earlier, this is not a men versus women debate. This is not a women good, men bad, bad, take away from men. That's not what this is about. This is about diversity. Gender at board level happens to be a shortcut to diversity of thinking because there are still so few women at top levels in businesses. So we think that's the easiest one for businesses to do something about. And throughout our book, there's 41 strategies for success in the book. There's 41 ways as a woman, as a pragmatic feminist, you can overcome a problem or a situation that you might face. But there are also 41 pieces of advice for businesses about how they should be managing their businesses better to ensure that they don't lose talented women from their pipeline. Because most businesses, the only place that women are in a minority is at the top.
So this is a piece of research that was done by, I think it was PwC, that said too many women don't want to reach the top. Only 41% of the 200 successful women we interviewed declared an aspiration to join the C-suite. Now, Sue is a chief strategic officer. I work in the world of film, so I can say this, that statistic is utter cack.
A technical term.
That's a technical term, but it's utter cack. However, I have never been in a room with 10 women and 6 of them have gone, actually, I want a really, really average career. I don't aspire to get to the top. I'd like to just have a little humdrum life. And the most exciting thing I have in my day is to go home and maybe heat up a Waitrose ready meal. Hurrah! I spent all my time going to university and working really, really hard. But what I don't want to do is really, really run a company. Oh, and possibly earn more. Oh, and tell people what to do. It's utter, utter cack. I don't know who they interviewed. Maybe they'd been hit on the head. Or maybe they were drunk. Or possibly both. But it's rubbish. I've never, ever met women who've gone, no, my aspirations are really small. Please don't bother me. Please don't give me a pay rise. No, and for heaven's sake, don't promote me. I can't possibly tell people what to do. It's rubbish. So, the glass ceiling doesn't exist anymore, apparently. It's all been broken by legislation. That's why there's so many men called David running companies. But we're not going to worry about that. We're here to talk about the glass wall. And the glass wall is what exists between men and women in the workplace. You know what it's like when you're behind a glass wall? I'm talking, but you're not quite sure what I'm saying. So I have to resort to mime to tell you what I want. But there's this glass wall, and it comes down. It's the meetings you don't get invited to. It's the email trails you get dropped off. And if you're a man, it's standing behind that wall going, where have all my talented women gone? Where did they all just disappear? There were loads of them at graduate level, and oh, I just seem to have let them slip through my fingers, and none of them are running the C-suite. The glass wall sometimes is brought down by women themselves because they restrict their ambition because they think it's not the right thing to do. So we're here to smash that glass wall down, and we hope you're going to come on the journey with us.
And it's about a heritage, patriarchal, toxic system at work that is holding businesses back. And there is huge competitive advantage for businesses that do something about it. We spoke to over 100 people for the writing of the book.
That man wasn't one of them, because we wouldn't interview someone who wore a towel on his head. But
all of the stories in the book are based on stories that were told to us by our interviewees, both inside the UK and outside the UK. Nearly everybody that we spoke to, so we made it across the board, said, yes, Sue Catherine, you can use my story. Please change my name. Then they said, please change the business sector that I work in. And then some of them said, could you set it in another country? So they are all based on fact, but they're as disguised as the people who told us the stories want them to be.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
There is quantitative research as well, done by our friends at Lightspeed Research for the UK, US and Russia, which also puts an interesting light on some of the stories. And we'll come on to that. So what we're going to do is we're going to just tell you 3 or 4 of the stories in the book, and then we're going to take some questions. So, this is Peter. Peter is 2.5. Peter has just been on his first ever proper Easter egg hunt that he's participated in. And Peter's story was told to me by Jane, his mum, who works at a very senior level in a government-run business. And what she said was, she said, we've been having these Easter egg hunts for about 3 years now. All the families, 3 families get together. The mums and dads sort of sit in a circle and we have a picnic and we drink Chardonnay and we eat Scotch eggs because you only eat Scotch eggs.
This is so
scary. You only eat Scotch eggs on picnics. When else would you
eat Scotch eggs on picnics? It's not true.
The dads go and hide the Easter eggs in the Bluebell Woods, and there's little foil-wrapped Easter eggs, and also, you know, there's little foil-wrapped Lindt bunnies. Other chocolate brands are available, but you know the ones I mean. And then the older kids help the younger kids search for the eggs, and the kids all go and take them back to the picnic area, and then they share them out. And the older kids help the younger kids. And it just so happened that Peter was the only boy. All the other kids were little girls, ranging in age from 10 to Peter and his sister, who were twins at 2.5. And this is how it had always gone, until this particular year, until the first year that Peter was really properly old enough to get involved. And that year, Peter came running back into the circle much sooner than all the other kids, and everybody was sort of, oh, what's wrong? Something happened. Peter jumped into the middle of the circle, and he held up a gold Lindt bunny, and he said, I've won! I've won! Mummy and Daddy, I've won! I found the gold bunny! And Peter's mum, Jane, said she could she knew what the other mothers were thinking. She said she knew that the other mothers were thinking, well, first of all, right, first of all, there's more than one gold limp bunny, right? Number two, no one's ever won the Easter egg hunt before. But, you know, look at this little face. You wouldn't want to crush Peter, would you? So it's a bit of an awkward silence. And then Peter's dad says, yes, Peter, you've won. You've beaten all the girls. Well done, Peter. And Jane said, she told me the story, and she said, as she told me the story, and she said, knowing that Peter's dad, if Peter's twin sister had run back into the circle and said, I've found the golden bunny, I've beaten everyone else, he wouldn't have said, well done you've beaten all the girls. I wouldn't. But she said, I realised that that's basically what happens in my office. The boys show off and I don't. So she works in a very busy industry, very high stakes, and she said that when her boss passes her in the corridor and says to her, hi Jane, how are things going? She says, it's all fine, don't worry about a thing, everything's under control. And she said, I know, talking to you, I've realised that when my boss passes my male colleague equivalent in the corridor and says, how are things going? He says, it's all fine now, don't worry about a thing, there was a huge problem, but I solved it. So when it comes to the next round of promotions or the next round of pay rises, who does he think is treading water and just coping with everything that's going on? And who does he think is problem solving? And that's one of the biggest divides that we've found. We've tried to avoid gender stereotypes with the writing of the book, but there are things that have come up time and time again, both in our talks and in the interviews, and it's that there is a difference in terms of how much you're happy to show off about what you do and you don't do, and that seems to be defined by your gender and the culture that we grow up in. So advice to Jane, find a way to show off a bit more. Advice to the business that she works for, have a look beyond who's in your face telling you what a brilliant job they've done and go looking for the quieter people who are just getting on with it.
It's a slightly different story. No children were harmed in the making of this story. It's about a woman who gets promoted. Two colleagues are already at that level. She gets promoted, and at first everything's lovely. She's very excited. Everything's going quite nicely. And then every week they have a meeting with a senior director to talk about progress, how they're doing, how they're hitting their KPIs, what targets they've hit. And suddenly the boys start saying, oh, yeah, we talked about that, and we've decided we're going to do this. And she realises that she's not part of those discussions. And there's a whole narrative that's developing around the direction of travel for their department that she's not part of. And she can't quite work out how this is happening, because they sit in an open plan office, as everyone does nowadays, all a bit strange. And she starts feeling that she's kind of just falling behind a little bit, which as the most newly promoted member of the management team, she can't really afford to do. And then she notices that what's happening is the boys are going to go off and have their little chats in the gents, the one place she can't go. Really obvious that they're going there. She can't go there. And she gets angrier and angrier until one day she sees them walking in there together. And she walks up and she pushes the door open. And she says, boys, I'm in on this meeting, so let's all have a little bit of a chat. Yeah. Quite bold, brave, but she was so cross that she just thought if she didn't do that, she was just going to gradually, you know that great phrase, I'm drowning, not waving? She was drowning, not waving. And there was a lot of, oh God, what are you, no, we're just here. And it's like, yeah, really? Not really. People walking past, quite humiliating. She had checked out that she wasn't going to be privy to any deep personal secrets by pushing the door open, by checking with a male colleague. And it changed like that. They never left her out again because they knew that she would push herself into places where she was uncomfortable to make her mark and step up. Now, it's a strange story, but it's one about being angry. Women are very, very ambivalent about being angry at work. And it's because we see it as a loss of control. It's not the right thing to do. You should never let your emotions get carried away with you. And our tip is to take that anger and turn it into a fuel that pushes you into places where it makes you braver and slightly uncomfortable. Uncomfortable is a good place to be. Who wants to be in the same place always? You want to be a tad uncomfortable with where you're pushing yourself because you're going to different areas. And it was really, really extreme. But what else was she going to do? Sit there and gradually look like she was some patsy who'd been promoted above her level and she should really probably best leave. And the story that she discovered later on was that one of the chaps who she suspected was the biggest instigator of her being pushed aside, had got his own little protege who he'd have liked to have got into that job, and it didn't happen that his protege got the job. So what's best to do? Just shove her aside gradually and then sweep your person in. So don't be afraid to be angry. I mean, obviously don't stab people because that would be somewhat life-destroying and career-limiting. But use your anger. Do not be afraid of your anger. And for businesses, always make sure that if there's someone in the room as part of a discussion, to be ever so slightly puzzled at the direction of what's going on, either establish that, make sure that they're part of the discussion, seek out their opinion, ask what they're doing, make sure that your team is homogenous in the way it's working forward and there's none of these kind of silos developing.
Can I have a show of hands? Who knows who this bunch of fine young men are? Anyone? I didn't know either.
Oh, no?
Oh, yeah, one. Oh.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Mm-hmm.
You're working towards the answer and I'm loving your work.
I didn't know either. They are certainly are football players. And who they are is part of the next story, which is about Sarah. So Sarah has a new boss called Jim. But Sarah's boss, Jim, is not new to her. They've worked together for 5 years. He's just been promoted above her. Sarah is really actually quite happy about this. She thinks he'll be a great MD. She's quite impressed with him. And she's pleased that the fact that they've been working together closely for 5 years, that they've got a good relationship, and so she knows she'll be able to communicate well with him. So the very first time that she goes in to suggest a new strategy to him, this is what happens. There was a situation in the organisation that she worked in where the planners weren't getting on with the buyers. It's very common in most businesses. Perhaps in universities, the academics don't necessarily get on with the people who are running finance for the organisation. That can occasionally happen.
Obviously never here.
Not here.
That would never happen.
No. Sometimes in organisations that are arts-based, a newspaper or a BBC or something, the reporters think they are the most important people there. The people, again, running the governance of the organisation go, well, if we didn't sort out where the advertising income came from, you wouldn't exist. So it's a very common thing, the one set of people, another set of people. And they kept blaming each other. So in this instance, the planners were saying that the buyers didn't listen, and the buyers were saying that the planners didn't spend any time with them. And Sarah, who was head of planning, was just sick of this and decided that what she'd do is she'd go into Jim's office and she'd make a suggestion about what they could do instead. So she walked into Jim's office and she said, "Do you know this situation about the planners not getting on with the buyers?" And he went, "Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?" She said, "Yes, I think I've got a solution. Let's run a role reversal course. We'll have the planners be the buyers for a day. We'll have the buyers be the planners for the day. They'll understand each other's pressures. It will all get better." And there was a pause. And then he said, "Remember, it's the first time she's been in with a suggestion since he got promoted. Always got on very well." He goes, "That's a really terrible idea. That's a really terrible idea. Shall I tell you why? Shall I tell you why it's such a terrible idea?" It's quite big, this chat. It's looming. The finger's pointing. "Shall I tell you why it's such a terrible idea?" And she's sort of thinking, actually, maybe not so much, actually, if you're in this kind of... She goes, "Okay." He goes, "Because I want them to focus. I want them to focus. The last thing I want is the planners to worry about the buyers and the buyers to worry. I want them to focus. If they just all focused and did their job properly, there wouldn't be this problem." And she goes, "Okay." And she kind of backs out of the room. And she said to me, as she was telling me this story, she's obviously disappointed. She said, "There's three things that probably she could have done. One of them is she could have got straight on the phone to a headhunter and said, get me another job. I'm never going to have a good relationship with him. He can't get over the fact that I used to work with him and now I work for him. I'm a talented person. Get me out of here."
Yeah.
Would have been
didn't
all
involve
right.
eating strange creatures, yeah. though. Thank
would
heavens.
Have been all right, probably, for her and her career. Probably less good for the business because she was a talent. She could have gone back to her desk and gone, yes, sorry. It was a stupid idea, wasn't it? Sorry, I shouldn't have done that. How likely would she have been to ever have an idea ever again? Not very likely. Bad for her, bad for the business. She could have done this, and this is probably what I would have done, which is stayed up all night, because so keen on the idea, stayed up all night, researched all the learned papers on it, had a look at the LSE, see if there's any factual evidence, come up with all the sources of why this was such a good idea, and then tried to present a 30-slide deck to her boss the next day. Yes, you can tell how well that would have gone.
He would have been in the mood for a 30-slide deck, obviously.
As it happened, she didn't do any of those things. What she did instead was she went home and she had a bit of a moan to her other half about what had happened. And this was interesting. He didn't say, oh, poor you, Jim's terrible, that's awful. He didn't go, let me pour you a glass of Chardonnay and you know, poor you. What he did was he said, oh, it sounds a bit like Dutch total football from the 1970s. Did you say that? And she said, of course. She said, I've never heard of Dutch. I promise you, it's not. You don't have to have been around in the 1970s to have heard of the Dutch total football team in the 1970s. It's kind of a famous thing if you're into football. They basically won every trophy. And the technique that they used for training was that famously everybody trained in everybody else's position. So the goalie trained as a striker, the striker trained as defence, and that's how they trained. So they all knew what each other was doing, and it meant that they had better understanding of passing each other the ball. So she goes back to work the next day. He explains this to her. She goes back to work the next day. She walks into Jim's office. Jim's going, you haven't come back in with that idea, have you? Because he's annoyed again, because he knows he's been mean to her. So it's made him more annoyed. And she goes, just occurred to me that it's a little bit like Dutch total football from the 1970s. And he says, that's an excellent idea. He says, it will give us brilliant competitive advantage. How soon can you organise it? Okay, first of all, Jim obviously needs to improve his listening techniques. But secondly, I gift you, any of you who know who work in a similar situation, the footballing analogy. But it's not really about the footballing analogy. It's about speaking the right language. So my chair is a wonderful woman called Karen Blackett, who happens to be a cricket fanatic. Cricketing is the thing, is the language to speak to Karen. Catherine here. Movies, obviously, because Pearl and Dean, she runs Pearl and Dean, so any kind of movie analogy will work. I'm a bit of a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan, if anyone wants to.
Because obviously there are thousands of analogies in Buffy the Vampire Slayer that are applicable
to work.
You just
haven't watched it thoroughly enough,
yeah,
Catherine.
Yeah.
So the point is, speak the language.
See, seamlessly put together, you see, with a film reference. This isn't what we all do, by the way. This is my office. Please, yes. Please let the next blockbuster be good and lots of people go and see it. I beg of you.
That's how it works.
Yes, that is how it works. Please let Batman versus Superman come back and be better next time. Oh no, that would be impossible. Anyway, so this is about the conspiracy of the sisterhood. It's always really, really important to have a kind of a gang with you. Doesn't have to be, you know, but the sisterhood gang is kind of quite key.
Quite
and this
special.
Is just, and special, yeah. You know, for example, I have known Sue so long that it's like something from the Cretaceous period, and I can't even remember when I first met her. She's just always been part of my working life. Anyway, this is about two women. They work together, had each other's back. You know that kind of whole thing in meetings? Oh, God. Don't go in and see him. He's in a really, really shit mood. Okay, save that idea for later. You know, jacket on the back of the chair when you come back from a slightly late lunch or you've gone shopping and forgotten what the time is. All that kind of thing. They had each other's backs. And they got to a certain level and then one of the women left. And she took a bit of a risk in her career. Took a bit of a turn, but she went on to become an absolutely stellar success in this role, much lauded, really fabulous. The friend that she left behind, her life took a slightly different turn. So she decided that what she was going to do was to have a child, and that was great. And while she was pregnant with her first child, she got promoted. And she came back from maternity leave, and the world's changed a bit. Now, Sue knows this about me, but if I go on holiday for 2 weeks, I can't even remember my computer password. So I have to write it in an envelope for myself because, yeah. So that's the reason why I've never taken extended maternity leave, is because I probably wouldn't be able to switch the computer on. But she came back, and she'd been promoted, and she'd got this really big new job, and it all felt a little bit overwhelming. So what did she do? She called her girlfriend up and said, listen, you know, I need a bit of input from you. You're so successful. You can help me, can't you? You've done all this. You've conquered everything in front of you. And so they went for a glass of wine or three. And her friend said, I tell you what you need to do. You need to really get yourself back in it. You need to network at least once a week. You need to put yourself maybe on some panels where, you know, you can up your profile a bit. Yeah, and take on some really, really interesting new projects. And this girl sat there and she said, I genuinely thought to myself, I have lost my mind because my baby isn't sleeping. It gets to Thursday afternoon and I am counting down the hours to Friday because I am so tired that I just can't cope. And maybe I just am a bit shit, really. And my girlfriend's so good and she's telling me to do this and this doesn't feel right. And the thing about the conspiracy of the sisterhood is, her old friend probably meant really, really well, but what suited her didn't suit her friend who was in her new situation. And what you've got to do is, if you seek for someone who's going to be a sponsor or a mentor, is you need someone who likes you and is interested in you, but has no emotional connection with you whatsoever. They want you to succeed, but there's no thing about Jonathan. Do you remember that time, you and I, God, that night out, it was crazy. Yeah, anyway, this is how to get on in your job. Obviously, Jonathan and I aren't going to talk about that now. But, you know, it's that whole thing about it's great having shared history, but don't assume that means you've got a shared future. Find someone who cares about you, wants you to do well, and can take you to the places you need to get to, not someone who's got a past with you. So that's the conspiracy of the sisterhood.
This is a piece of our quant research. So we asked business people across the UK, the US, and Russia to simply put their communication style at work, their persona at work, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is highly feminine, perhaps think Marilyn Monroe, skirt blowing up, it's the wrong sort of skirt.
Yeah, don't
and,
do that.
Yeah. 10 maybe is Maggie Thatcher, kind of, you know, more sort of steely, both men and women. And we've got the results of this quant survey. We've also talked about it quite a lot at talks, and it always raises a lot of discussion. And we've also, I've talked about it to the people that I work with, and I happen to have worked at my current job for a ridiculously long amount of time. I started when it was very small, it's now very large, it's over a couple of decades. So I've worked with some people, I've got some colleagues that I've worked with for a very long time. And when I was in the course of writing the book with Catherine, I asked one of them, one of the men who's one of my bosses, I said to him, what do you think about this, and where would you put yourself on a scale of 1 to 10. And I'll just ask you while I'm talking to perhaps think about where you'd put yourself. We'll do a show of hands in a minute, just out of interest. Where you put yourself. So I said, and where would you put yourself on a scale of 1 to 10? And he said, I think I put myself at a 7 or 8. He said, he's sort of saying I'm in touch with my feminine side. I'm not 10, I'm not 11. He said, where would you put yourself, Sue? So I said, I think I'd put myself at 6 or 7. And he said, hang on a second. He said, wait a minute, he said. Now, I know how much he values the contribution that I make to the office. But when I said 6 or 7, he said, yes, but he said, look at what you're wearing, he said. I said, you're wearing a pink dress. He said, that makes you a 2 or a 3. Oh, okay. This is what you mean by language. I didn't realise that was a thing. I didn't realise that for you to think of me in this side of the spectrum, I'd have to wear trousers. If I...
Beautifully put together, you see, skirt, trousers. We've done this before.
It's interesting. Does that mean, given that it's always good to know the mindset of the person that you're going in to ask for something from, that if I want to get something out of you, I should think about very carefully about how I dress and therefore the immediate first impressions, even after you've worked for me for all this time? That was very interesting. We spoke to someone who runs a very senior women's network at one of a large engineering firm. And she had done the exercise with her team, and they all wrote down the numbers that they would score themselves at, and then they swapped numbers, scored each other, scored themselves, swapped numbers. And her number two, the woman that reports into her, had scored her a 2, and she had again scored herself 7. And they looked at the numbers, and they discussed that that was interesting. And then her number two said to her, "But look," she said, "I've got to say, I'm so, so sorry that I scored you as a 2. And she said, "Why are you apologising? 2 is good. 2 just behaves a bit differently or comes across a bit differently. 2 is strong. 2 is great. Why are you apologising for..." So that was all quite interesting. In terms of the could we just have a show of hands? If you would place yourself at 5 to 10, can you put your hand up? And... Oh, it should be 6 to 10, shouldn't it? Would that be hands
six
down?
To ten.
6 to 10, can't do sums. 6 to 10, hands up. And then 5 or less. So, yeah, so it's a little bit more 6 to 10, but it's just all quite interesting. In the quant research that we did in fact find that women do have a scale of 1 to 10. About 30% of women overall, somewhat more in Russia, actually more like 40% in Russia, would score themselves kind of 5 and above. There are only 5% of men who would score themselves at 5 or less. And in Russia, there are no men that would score themselves 5 or less.
Well, in fact, they'd like it to go up to 15.
I think
if you could go to 15, that would be really brilliant.
I think, and isn't this interesting, that women perhaps have a range of 1 to 10 and men perhaps have a range of 5 to 15. I don't know. I think how you see yourself and how you position yourself, and it turns out what you wear.
Yeah.
All is all part of this, even with people that you've worked with for a long time.
So it's an interesting thing to think about when you're going to go and ask for something, which is, depending on the ask you're making, do you wear, I mean, obviously this applies to women only, or men you could do, that would be a beautiful change. Do you wear a pink dress if you're going to go in and ask for something softer? If you're feeling a bit more powerful, or you want to do a big hard ask, do you wear, you know, trousers? Depends on how it works in your office. I have a pair of shoes that I have at work, which are called taxi shoes. And if I really want to intimidate people and make myself a lot taller, I have these shoes. The bottoms are barely scuffed. But we have a certain person that we have regular interaction with. And if I wear those shoes, it makes me look like I'm kind of quite powerful and I'm taller. I can't actually walk any distance in them, but I wear them. And if I wear them and quite a lot of lipstick, which I don't do normally, I know it scares the bejesus out of them because it isn't the way that I normally look. And I know it's a thing, and maybe I shouldn't do it, but why wouldn't I play the system?
Why wouldn't you do it? Why play the system? And as I say, it's not obvious which way it would pan out. It's just something to think about. For businesses to succeed, things need to change. For personal satisfaction all round, things need to change. This is our book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Over to you for questions.
Thank you so much for this talk. I think we've all enjoyed it. And so I think we're going to open the floor to questions. I'd like to ask you to... be patient because we'll have the mics brought to you by our stewards. I'd ask you to please introduce yourself and your affiliation. Also, I thank you for have turned your phones to silent. I forgot to mention that earlier.
Everyone knows.
And I ask if you can continue that behavior. I would appreciate that. Further, there will be a podcast of this session for your viewing later. Of course, that's if we do not have any technical difficulties. But there should be a podcast available for you. So are we ready? Okay. Let's start here.
Thank you. Nancy Bishop. I work in film also. I'm wondering about the sisterhood you mentioned, because I think there is an absence of it sometimes. And in some of the research that I've done, that tends to be what turns up, is that sometimes it's women keeping other women back. And a related question about the word feminism, which we still seem to have a hard time with. And I'm afraid, am I getting her name right? It's Megyn Terry from Fox News that had the autobiography out, yeah, right? Who went through a terrible time with being sexually harassed and came through it and then still says she's not a feminist. And I don't know, maybe we don't have to worry about that if people call themselves feminist or not. So,
I mean, we had a show of hands at a Q&A that we did. One company who would call themselves a feminist and who wouldn't. And it's interesting, it was actually towards the end of that conversation in that case, and it caused quite a divide. And it caused, in fact, we had a panel on stage, and I think it was split 50-50. Two said they were feminists, two said they weren't feminists. I think it's about what you mean by the word, because I think nearly everybody would say, I believe that men and women should be treated fairly in the workplace. I'll declare I would absolutely call myself a feminist, but I don't think that the panel that we had, the ones who wouldn't call themselves feminists, I think they just think that it means something else. I'm not sure how helpful it is to use that as a dividing line, because I think if you change the question, it's a bit like the Brexit question, if I dare to say so, which is if the question had been, could we have a fairer relationship with the EU, there would have been a different answer to. So I think it's something like, do you think everyone should be treated fairly at work? One of the big issues that's come out, though, is that fairness is not the same as treating everybody the same. And perhaps we can talk about that. But I'm going to let Catherine talk about
the sisterhood.
Sisterhood.
So I think the sisterhood thing is important, and I use Sue as my sounding board because she cares about me, but fundamentally, you know, she cares about me as a person, but she doesn't have any history with me or my company. And I'm very lucky, you know, I belong to a group called Women in Advertising and Communications London. That's really, really great women. We do lots of work for women coming up through advertising and communications. And I'm not saying that the sisterhood is a bad thing. And actually, I'll be your friend in film, you know. Happy to have another friend in film, because there aren't that many women, you know, and it's really, really difficult. And I think that the sisterhood is a great thing, because it does stop you sitting on the tube or on the bus on the way home going, is it just me? Is it just me? Am I the only person this is happening to? And actually, you're not. The thing about that story was there was too much emotional investment in it. And if you're looking for someone who's going to push you to the next level, it might be someone who you just say what's happening in your life and they say, yeah, but he's clearly an idiot and you're never going to get anywhere there, so you should leave and go and work somewhere else. Whereas someone who's got history with David would say, oh, he's just a bit moody. You know what he's like. Just keep on pushing on. Someone who cares about you but doesn't have any connection with your company will go, no, he's an idiot, leave, because you're better than him. But, and that's the thing.
But also, if you're asking, are there women in power who are not helpful to other women coming through? Yeah, because they've succeeded in a system and they don't see why the system should necessarily change, which is also true of some men in power, but not all men in power. I think the important thing is not to just gender stereotype it, because it occasionally happens, because there are plenty of women that will give you a leg up. Just as there's plenty of men that will give you a leg up, actually. It's about finding the right ones.
This lady in the centre.
Hi, I'm Katie Huang, a freelance management consultant. I also have a question about the sisterhood. So I'm a chemical engineer by training, and I've always had a lot of male friends. And what my turning point was when I became a mother, I found I actually sympathized and had a lot more in common with other women than before. So that's when I start to reach out to other women at work and really focus on how we could support each other. And I was curious from your research whether that came out at all.
I think the answer is it, in most... Do you mean the bit about motherhood being a turning point in terms of that?
And also the sisterhood, because I think a lot of... Sorry.
Just clarify the question.
Sorry, I guess, like, before you have children, it's easier to hang out with the boys and be one of the boys.
Right, okay.
But I found when I became a mother, I had a lot of other issues that was completely unrelated to work.
Yeah.
And then so that actually gave me a lot of... So, like, so now I have more female friends than male friends, and used to be, like, 10% women, 90% men, and now it's flipped totally. And so I just was curious if that came out in your research at all, when women rely on the sisterhood more when they go through a major lifestyle change.
I guess it's shared experiences.
Yeah.
And the truth is that in this country there are more men in senior management with a stay-at-home partner than there are women in senior management with a stay-at-home partner, which tends to mean that when you've had a kid, but it might not be about having a kid, I mean, it could be who's going to take the puppy to the vet, or it could be caring for elderly parents. It's not exclusively childhood, but that when you find yourself in that situation, you're often ending up doing two full-time jobs and juggling everything, and that's more characterized for women than it is for men, who tend to find that things get done. So one of the issues in our industry is the influx of robots, and everyone's going, you know, robots going to take our jobs. And I once wrote a blog about it at the request of a couple of organisations, and I kicked off by saying, this thing's happening automatically, robots, that's really interesting. There's all sorts of very powerful men in the world of advertising who found that automatically a cup of tea appears on their desk.
Automatically their children get taken to school. It's remarkable.
They get to, there's events for them in the school holidays and a clean shirt on the bedpost every morning. And I think that's more often, and certainly traditionally has been more often, men's experience than it is women's experience, because you end up doing it all. But frankly, it's true of unmarried, unchilded women without children as well, in the sense that the whole hair, makeup, shoes that you can't walk in, skirts you can't stand, sit down. Women, we do that. Men do that less. Men have a uniform that they put on. I don't want a gender stereotype, but often it looks like they've scratched their head, maybe. Women have spent an hour going, is it straight? Is it curly? Is it big enough?
You've got a whole thing about your big hair.
Oh, big hair.
You know, and so that is one of the differences. So it is one of the places where we have shared experiences and can help each other.
I've only got a thing about the hair, because whenever you read anything about people like Marissa Mayer or Sheryl Sandberg or what have you, people always talk about their hair. I mean, what is that? No one has ever gone, Sir Martin Sorrell is rocking an attractive swept back style this year that shows off his tanned complexion, da-da-da-da-da.
He is my boss, he probably
obviously, he is an incredibly handsome man, very powerful, and we love him because he's clever enough to employ us. But no one ever says that. No one ever says, oh, Lord Brown, he had great hair. Didn't he have great hair? Great hair. Never talk about it. Women, obsessed by
but
hair.
But also, no one ever asks your husband the questions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have this very, very strange thing. So my husband works in advertising as well, and he runs, I shouldn't mention it. Cause
he
it's
has
a
big job.
He has a big job. No, I wasn't going to mention it because it's a competitor to you, but obviously, you know. But anyway, he's got a big job. No one ever said, people say to me quite often, so you're a CEO and you have children. How do you manage that? No one ever says to my husband, you're a CEO and you have children. How do you manage that? It's like this magical thing happens. Like I have, you know, Harry Potter fairies that just... He has Harry Potter fairies or what have you that just bring children up. No one's ever said to him, how do you manage? Someone said to me once when I was on a business trip when I was in the States, said, you must be really missing your children. No one ever says to him, you must be really missing your children. Yeah. You must be really missing your wife now. Actually, I'm desperate to get away from her. It's just this really, really weird thing.
Great. So,
he's determined to get you doing kind of, you know, work on your
monitor in the right here. Yes.
Hi, thank you very much. Really enjoyed the talk. My name is Marta. I work at the Wellcome Trust. I'm in the percentage aspiring to be at the top. I wear dresses most of the time, and I have no problem showing off and going into the gents' bathrooms.
Excellent.
But a lot of the advice I've been getting, not only from my mentors, but also I heard today, is about how you can change some of your traits to become more male, in a sense, showing off, for example. And I do wonder whether that is the right direction to go in, and whether the fact that boards with women are more successful are in fact due to the fact that women are different to men.
Well, it's about flexing. So we have been asked, are you saying that we should behave more like men in the book? No, we're not. But you don't have a single authentic self. We have multiple authentic selves. I mean, most of us are not exactly the same person with their friends from school, or with their elderly relatives, or with their work colleagues, or with their children if they're old enough, or with their, you know, grandparents. It's different versions of ourselves. What we're suggesting is that you tactically dial up or dial down various traits in order to successfully game the system, because in every workplace there is a system to game. And to think that you can just achieve success by doing the job, I'm afraid, is extremely rare and extremely unlikely. So you need to flex those flex points, and it sounds like you're doing very well.
Yeah, I mean, remain you, the authentic you, but just realise that you've got a panoply of talents that you can play with, and it's not just, don't be one-dimensional. So, you know, we've given talks and where women have said, well, you know, I work really, really hard and I still haven't been promoted. And I'm working really hard.
I know I'm doing better than my colleagues.
And I know I'm doing better than my colleagues and I'm not being promoted. And we're just saying to her, well, game the system a bit. Play the system, because quite a lot of other people are playing the system, and there isn't a, you know, there isn't a thing where what happens is suddenly, you know, the chief operating officer wakes up and goes, I know, there's someone in a tower who's doing lots of really great work. I must rush to them, pop a tiara on their head and make them princess of the world and promote them. They're not. They're too busy getting on with their own work. It's that whole thing about getting someone's focus, getting someone's eye line, and just make sure that in your own way, while remaining true to yourself, you just point out what a great asset you are to the company. They're not employing you just to get you out the house and stop you watching daytime television. They're employing you at the Wellcome Trust because you're bloody good at what you do, and you just need to just occasionally remind them that you're really, really good at what you do.
We did a talk at a city firm, and they had a whole set of their women that they were fast-tracking, and then some of those most senior men partners. And at the end of the talk, we said, so have we said anything useful? Has anybody learned anything? And one of the men stood up and he said, it's never occurred to me that women don't show off. He said, I've been showing off since the day I stepped through these doors. That's how I got this job. All the men around me show off all the time. I mean, it's constant noise. It has never occurred to me that if a woman doesn't show off, it's not that she doesn't have anything to show off for. He said, I just thought the women around me have been treading water and that's why they haven't been showing off. So it can be very difficult to do to begin with, and you can call that unconscious bias and you can call that sexism if you like. I don't think it is any of those things. I think it's just different languages. It's the glass wall. And, you know, as you sort of wade through it or just smash it down gently, those things become easier the more you do them, and it's not a betrayal of your whole persona. It's just flexing.
Yeah.
Okay, over here. yes, this gentleman right there.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Hattie. I work for the government. It's a question actually leading on from the showing off point about likability, because I have quite a lot of reticence in showing off success that I think many women feel. And my question is, do you think that when women do it, it's always received in the same way? Because we are part of this system where men and women behaving in the same way is sometimes received in a different way. So, for example, I think there's research around women asking for a salary increase and they might get it, but people don't like them anymore. So then you kind of feel like you're in a situation where you can't really win?
They're not employing you. You don't go to work to be liked. If you want to be liked, get a dog. Frankly, I mean, you know, I have a teenage child, and I got a dog because my teenager doesn't speak to me anymore. At least the dog's happy when I get home. I know it's not about me. No, I'm joking. You know, you are at work. You know, you will find your people at work. You're not there to be liked. They didn't employ you because they employ you to turn up, do a job, and do the best you can. And that whole likability thing really holds women back. As long as you're not gratuitously unpleasant to people and leave people crying, you know, at their desks, it is that thing. It's really, really hard. But you've also got to have the realisation, which you get as you're older, which is not everybody's going to like you. They might resent you, not for who you are, but because you got a better degree than them, or you live in a better area than them. Those are their biases that they're bringing that, you know. I mean, it is quite difficult when you work somewhere and you know that someone doesn't like you because you're female, because, frankly, there's not a lot I can change about that. That is what I am. And so the likability thing is find your tribe.
Your allies.
And your allies. And be with them, but don't expect everybody to like you. You know, there is a... I've got a really, really dear friend who works in banking, and one of her jobs at the end of the year is to do the handing out the bonus things. And she just said, for the period leading up to then, everybody loves her. Everybody loves Jo. Can I tell you, Jo, you're looking gorgeous at the moment? Yeah, da, da, da. And the minute it hands out, they're always really disappointed, and then she is literally the Wicked Witch of the West. And it is that thing, which is the likability thing, is as long as you like yourself and you've got some people who are with you, it doesn't matter. And I think we confuse likability with them rewarding us. Oh, they, you know, and you ask for a pay rise and you don't get in, it's because they don't like you. It's not. It's because there's probably a cash flow crisis. They've been told to keep wage rises below a certain percentage, et cetera, et cetera. And women walk away and go, they hate me, ruin my relationship with them. We know that because we've talked to women in the book, and it's not about that. And it is a thing about you're a really nice person, you've got friends, they just don't have to be all have to be at work. Which is brutal, but honest.
Right. Well, I'm rotating, so yes. Right here, please.
He's flexing.
Yeah.
Hi, thanks so much for the talk. I have two questions. So the first one is about, you kind of touched on it with the whole idea of a protege, and I kind of call it the boys' club. So you sort of mentioned breaking into it by going to the gents, but one thing that I find is that they'll go out for drinks and then I don't know about it till the next day. And I'm wondering how you would like advise on that sort of thing. And then the second point was on how you call out sexism at work, because there's a lot of, I guess it's called like microaggression, where it's just constant undermining based on your gender. And it's a joke, but it's kind of not, because it's so constant. But then when I've tried to call out, I get like really negative receptions. So I'm wondering if you have any strategies for that.
Okay, I'll deal with the banter, the so-called banter. Is this banter or is this low-level sexism? Am I going to say something or am I just going to back right off? One of my friends is a creative director at an advertising agency, and he said that he has a saying which he advises women on, which is that you go into the workplace, men insult each other all the time, but they don't mean it. Women compliment each other all the time, but they don't mean it. Now, whether that is exactly true or not, there is a lot of men who would not dream of upsetting someone, but they think they're including you when they're doing that round of banter. And we did a phone-in on LBC one night, and a young woman phoned in and said, they're always giving me put-downs. And we said, well, what kind of thing? And she said, well, they're saying to me, isn't it time you got back in the kitchen? Really? You said, really? We're in 2016, really? And then my advice to her was, first of all, maybe banter back. If it's not really offensive, banter back, as in they might think they're including her and that's the only way they can do it. And the fact that it's A, not funny, and B, upsetting her, is going over her head. So my advice is have some lines prepared in your handbag that you can use in those sorts of situations. For example, and goodness knows this isn't funny either, isn't it time you got in the back in the kitchen, Jamie Oliver? Might be a comeback to that. Ha ha ha, right? But it's a comeback. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that if it's continual, I would go to a senior person in the organisation and just ask them about it. And not, I'm calling this out and I'm ready to go to HR, but Catherine, I don't know if you've noticed, it's kind of, it's not so much that it's getting to me. This is, I would often say, it's not getting to me. It's just that Caroline here, who's more junior than me, I've seen how upset she is by it. So I wonder if you could perhaps have a word with them and get them to stop it. So that's a technique as well. If it is inappropriate, and that does happen, even in the best of cultures, number one, take the person aside. And again, I'd use the technique. I wouldn't necessarily say, you really upset me then, Jeff. What I'd say is, did you see how embarrassed Catherine was because of what you said to me? I know you wouldn't want to embarrass anybody. Perhaps you could be a bit careful about those kinds of comments. If it is unacceptable, then you do have to escalate. And I find myself noticing it more. I don't know if I'm noticing it more because we're post-Trump or in Trump, as it were. No, I should rephrase that, but you know what I mean. I don't know if I'm noticing it more because we've written a book called The Glass Wall, and therefore I'm noticing it more because it's more out there, and maybe people around me are doing it, you know, unconsciously, I don't know. But I was in a situation, as Catherine knows, where I was talking to someone who'd just taken over a new company in the north, and his sales are doing very well. And he said to me, I've really changed the culture. It's really great, Sue. And I said, good, it's really good. He was showing off to me, you know, really good. I'm so pleased. He said, we've changed the culture. He said, people don't just all go to the pub on Friday afternoons. I'm going, great, good, good. He said, we care about the work. Nobody cares who's in the meeting, whether it's the men or the girls. And I said, oh. And he said, oh, I should have said boys or girls, shouldn't I? And I said, well, or you could have said men or women. And I repeated this sort of anecdote to a couple of people. And they said, Sue, he was trying to impress you. He was talking about how things had changed for the better. Did you have to? And I said, yeah, do you know what? I did have to, because he's got women working for him. Is he seeing them, or is he seeing the men and the girls? So I think there's about 5 or 6 different techniques there, and I think you have to judge. But I would definitely, if it's regular bad jokes, devise some bad jokes back. Keep them in your handbag, because it's hard to think of them in the moment, and whip them out and see whether that works. That would be my first thing.
It's not as bad as I actually went to a meeting and someone said, oh, he refers to himself as the Archbishop of Banterbury. I mean, if someone said that in front of me, I would have to physically restrain myself from punching him, because it's not clever and it's not funny. And also, they are never funny. I mean, also saying things like, oh my God, I seem to have woken up in the 1950s works. I went with someone, a woman, very, very talented woman I work with, who had her second child. And someone said, God, see the thing with women? They have one baby and then it's like buses. They've got to have 3. And, you know, and then working women, which obviously I'm not one, so mothers. So I said, oh my God, we seem to have woken up in the 1950s. Is this some kind of horrible parody? It's like, oh God, oh God. And he just realised, and it's just that I think the other thing is sometimes as well, people just say stuff and it comes out, there's no filter with some men sometimes. And it's, oh, it's coming to my head, I'm just going to put it out there. Oh my Lord. All right, I'm going to pretend I'm not embarrassed, because then it'll just be too embarrassing. Just be too, yeah. Or just get someone like Lynn Parker, who runs Funny Women, to come in and give you some training courses. Yeah. She's brilliant.
Stand up.
Yeah, do some stand-up training. Always good.
Okay, over here in the front.
So my question is related to that, and it's about what do we do with the men who think they get it already, but they don't? So I sort of work in quite a male-dominated environment, and I've had a lot of really good male bosses who are very supportive of me. And I'm also the chair of the oldest young women's charity in the country, and I appointed our first ever male exec director earlier this year, sort of to give the girls a male role model in that position, but who could champion them. But the amount of times where I've had to say to him, all my male bosses, all the reason why that went tits up, using that phrase, was because you said something to a young woman that you probably shouldn't have and you hadn't really thought about it. That's where you went wrong. And they sort of look at me really funny, like they don't quite get it. I'm wondering if things like reverse mentoring or sort of how do we get them in the position of a young woman in the workplace that they can understand and they can check their behaviour next time round.
Reverse mentoring is a great idea. And also role play. In reverse mentoring, so get them to experience what it's like. I think quite a lot of the time, you know, they really think they've got it, and they just don't. And so reverse mentoring is always really, really good. And also get them to be part of the solution. So, and just say, look, this is a really great culture. We're moving in the right direction, but I'm trying to prepare these young women for the future ahead when they don't have such enlightened men working with them, so maybe you can be part of devising strategies for them, you know, and preparing them. And so what I'd like to do is reverse mentor, we'll do some role play, be really, really helpful, because it, and then the scales fall from their eyes. I mean, it is a very, very interesting thing that one chap said to me, yes, you know, I've had a daughter now and I realise just how unfair the workplace is. And so, yes, I'm completely on board with the idea of changing things. It's like, so what about your wife? What about your sister?
Ever had any women friends?
All of your women friends? It's okay for them to only earn, you know, 79p to every pound that a bloke earned, but now I have created a girl child.
It's literally like,
what is it, that the Lion King. Yeah. My girl child is born.
Everything must change.
And everything must change now because I don't want her to suffer, even though my wife probably worked for some beastly man and probably got paid about 10p. But it's all changed now because it's not going to happen to my little princess. So just turn it around. And just reverse mentoring is a great idea. You don't need the answer.
It's a great idea.
Got there already.
It's a great idea.
Blame us. Just go, I've met these dreadful women and they told me
stirring
to do this.
Stirring
it up. And I'm sorry, you need to change. It's not me saying that, it's them.
Thank you for your talk. Listening to you, it's become very clear to me that I really need a mentor. And when I think about the company which I work for, I can't think of a woman who would be appropriate, most certainly not my female manager. And I wondered if you had any advice. The thought that comes to me is looking for some industry network groups, but I feel there should be something more.
Yes, it should never be your boss. So your mentor should never be your boss, because a mentor needs to be able to give you, whether you like them, whatever they're like, it needs to be able to give you independent advice. And I actually, the other day, I got asked to mentor somebody within the organisation. I had to say to her, I can help find you a mentor. It should not be me, because I'm going to be thinking what's best for Mediacom, not what's best for you, and I can't stop myself doing that. So it shouldn't be somebody within the company, in my view. In terms of industry, I know about our industry and I don't know about outside industries. Certainly Institute of Practitioners of Advertising has a mentoring scheme.
Yeah.
I would think there would be equivalent ones, but maybe you're right. Maybe there's a... Who worked here for the government? Maybe that's a government thing we should set up, because it shouldn't necessarily be industry specific. It's a... What a great idea. Let's start something.
Yeah, you can lead
it.
Don't we? Come email me, you'll find me, and I'll try and find you someone. I know lots of women who love mentoring.
In the front here.
Just a simple question. Why does the mentor have to be another woman?
It can be anybody.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
It also doesn't have to be official, to be honest. I have three unofficial mentors. Two are men and one is a woman. Every single time I asked each of them when I was younger to be a mentor, they all three of them said, no, I'm too busy, so I'm not going to do it. And I thought, well, that's fine. I'm still going to, we'll go for lunch. I'll chuck a problem at you and you can chuck the answer back. So it doesn't have to be formal also.
No, and it doesn't have to be like therapy. You don't have to turn up every week with a problem and sob on them.
Sometimes I've had two for one in terms of men to women. I don't know about you. Have you had, what
did you say? Never had a mentor. I thought you were my mentor. Damn. No, I don't think I have. Which explains why she is where she is today.
Sorry, did you have a comeback that you wanted to...
Did you have follow-up?
Oh, you
just shout.
You mentioned, you showed us these numbers from 1 to 10, and you talked about communication, and we were talking about women getting dressed in dresses and using the pink color and all of this stuff. But I just wanted to say something about the research that I did. And I found in my research that men very often imitate women's behavior, and they adopt feminine behaviors and attitudes so that they get across other people. And we come from the hospitality industry, and it's very much people-oriented. And the men in my study said that they had to be more nurturing, and they had to be more like their female colleagues in order to be able to make the people do
that.
And it's just different techniques.
It's different techniques.
It's playing the game and playing the system.
Yeah, and you know, there's nothing, you know, and quite a lot of very great male bosses are inordinately nurturing and do that kind of thing because they're comfortable with that.
Hi, thank you for your talk. My name is Catherine Xiang. I work here at the LSE. I'm looking forward to reading your book about your research, but whilst you two are here, I just wondered if there's one strategy from your own personal career development you would like to share with us, what would that be?
It's always hard to pull one out, apart from the ones that we've already shared.
Resilience, the importance of resilience. So So you might not always get what you want the first time round, but build on your resilience. And it might be that it's going for a walk, yoga, blah, 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 whatever. Have something else that takes you away from it, because it's really easy to get hugely consumed by your job and then to think it's everything and your entire self is invested in your job. And when you get a setback, it's really saying, that's it, it's all over. But actually, you're going to live and fight another day, and you just need to develop your playbook of other things that you do that reaffirm you and make you feel good about yourself, and preferably not involving excessive use of alcohol, because that is not a good idea. But no, I mean, you know, so resilience is the key thing.
And mine, which I've now got, is disclosure, which is that... This has started to happen, which is people go, what's your favourite story from the book? And my mind immediately goes blank. And then I go, oh, my God, I had a moment when I was supposed to say what my favourite story was, and my mind goes blank, and beating yourself up about it. And my point is that nobody is perfect, and we have all screwed up. And I don't care how glamorous and how effective all the women out there are, they've all had their moments, and could we please all stop pretending that we're perfect? It isn't just me, is it?
No, it's not just you. Well, even if it's just us two, I don't really care, frankly.
So disclosure is good.
Okay. In the back here.
Next to my new mentor.
Actually, the one in the aisle behind the new mentor.
No, not her. No, you've had your share of love in that row. I'm sorry. You know.
Hello, my name is Anne. I work in the local government. And I'm so glad you talked about resilience, because that would have been my question. I'm responsible for the leadership and management strategy and activities for my local authority. So I'm going to avoid the resilience question because you've answered that. Tell me about how you become politically savvy without compromising your integrity.
I was at a wonderful training course last week, and somebody was talking about her techniques in meetings and how she will sometimes flatter the most important man in the meeting, and she feels bad about it but then she gets the outcome that she wants. And she said, that's terrible, isn't it? It's really manipulative. And we all said, well, not if it gets you the outcome that you want. Your integrity is not at stake. If I pour a glass of water for Jonathan
to make him be kinder to me in the Q&A. My integrity is not at stake. There is this big truth out there, which is that everybody wants to be acknowledged. And sometimes, in order to get the outcome that you want, you have to acknowledge people's feelings in a meeting that you might not find that attractive. So there might be a very senior chap who has spent his whole career building up, climbing a ladder of power structure and hierarchy, and he doesn't want to give any ground. It might be that for you to get the sign-off of the budget of the really big campaign that you want to put out there, you need to say to him, Jamie, only you can help me with this. Without your advice on this, I can't get anywhere. You know what? Is that being manipulative? Is that a little bit, can it be a little bit sick-making, maybe? Yeah. Isn't it brilliant if he then signs off your 50 grand budget so that you can do it? So I think the thing is to be strategic about it, not to take it personally. And a personal tip, I often think about myself, I hope this isn't going to sound too weird, I think about myself in that situation in the third person. So I don't think, oh, God, what have I got to do? I think, what would the successful person that got that budget out of Jamie, what would she have done? And that makes me better able to think about it objectively.
Show some love to
that row.
Bless them.
Thank you. I'm Joanna. I work at LSE.
One of the statistics from your presentation showed that much fewer women aspire to work their way up to the C-suite than men. I wondered if you think that's an issue or is it something that will always be the case?
I'll tell you what I think it is. I think it's women looking at the trappings of those positions and going, I don't want any of that. So I think it's about looking at a situation where to be the CEO of a business, it looks like you've got to work every weekend. It looks like you've got to be willing to jump on a plane at the drop of a hat.
Or it looks like you have to stab people in the back on the way there and be utterly ruthless. And if anybody comes anywhere near you, you stamp on their hands and go, no. You know, that whole ambition piece is really nuanced, isn't it, for women?
Now, that's a failing business that has that kind of attitude. Those are not the businesses that are thriving. So if you're in an organisation like that, then maybe you would go, you know, being C-suite means never seeing your kids at the weekend, you probably go, yeah, I don't want to take that on board. And it was a McKinsey bit of research thing, actually. So what it was that sort of sector. The question is this difference between treating people fairly and treating people the same. So one of the stories in the book is about a young woman who happens to be a single mum. It's come up to Christmas. Her only client is a very big client, and they're closed between Christmas and New Year. She's run out of holiday. She says to her boss, can I work from home? Because I've got a 2.5-hour commute into London, and my only client's closed. So, of course, I'll take phone calls, but they're closed. And he says to her, well, you should have saved your holiday, shouldn't you? Because I can't do that for you, because if I do that for you, what's... You know, Steve and Nick going to think that, yeah, sure, they haven't got any children, but I've got to treat everybody the same. Well, that's a bit mean, I think. That's not really showing love. It's not really showing consideration for talent. And yes, do you know what? Maybe she should have saved her holiday. But it was about this time of year. And you know what trains are like between Christmas and New Year. And so there she was getting on a train, sitting in her cold office, tidying her desk, getting back on the train and going home to her 2-year-olds. That's not treating people fairly. That's just treating people the same. And she's got out of that company now. She's not working there anymore. And they've lost some talent. And I think that spiral is the one that's holding businesses back, and it needs to be rethought.
Right here.
You're wielding the pen with
he is.
Godlike it is,
it's
authority.
Like, it's just like Harry Potter here, yes. Isn't it?
Well, I do teach the dark art at LSE. Yeah. Yeah.
We weren't going to say anything. But.
I'm Anne. I work at a contemporary art gallery. Just
moving forward with the last person's question, what you were just saying about working arrangements, in your research, did you find that companies that had elevated more women tended to have more flexible working conditions?
Oh, Sue can answer this question because she's got personal experience of it, haven't you?
Oh, well, yeah. Look, it depends, doesn't it, on the culture of the business, but my view is that better businesses have flexible working, and flexible working for all kinds of reasons, not just mums, actually. So Catherine's giving me a chance to show off a little bit about Mediacom, where we do have flexible working, but we also have a programme to help all kinds of people called Project Blend. It's not just about, oh, I've got a new baby and I don't know how to cope with it. We have wonderful Trace, who is a very serious triathlete and can't cope with her training and her work balance. And so we've put her through the programme to help her understand how best to create time for herself and for her business. Because the answer is that what everyone works for wants from work is outcome-based, right? They want a better profitability, or they want more sales, or they want more conversion of behaviour to X, Y, and Z. And if that's the focus, you don't need presenteeism. And so I would say, yes, more successful businesses have that diversity of thinking in how and what and how they manage their teams.
Can I tell another Mediacom story, which is that, which you won't say, but I can say because I don't work there. And so Mediacom is the biggest media agency in the UK. It's got billings of over $1 billion, lots of really lovely clients. And when they were going through their stratospheric build phase, of the 5 client-facing people, 4 of them were women, and of the 4 women, 3 of them worked flexibly. So work part-time. Now, if you turn around to anybody else in this highly competitive sector and said, I know what we're going to do. Of the 5 people, only one of them is going to be a man. And of the other 4, all 3 of them are going to work flexibly. People would have laughed in your face and gone, are you insane? Because that's never going to work, because media is a 24/7, 365 business, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not going to work. And yet, they are agency of the year on a really frequent basis. They get huge scores on their client satisfaction. I have, and I can say this because, you know, frankly, I don't care with the media. Well, I do because I care about Sue, but, you know, they don't pay me to say this. It is a place where if you go in there, you can feel the energy and the camaraderie. And people who work there love working there. And they did that and built this really successful business. Mm-hmm. With
and,
that
and I think
dynamic.
I think it's very kind of Catherine, but I think the interesting thing about it as well is that the women are diverse. And often what you get in organisations is you might get one woman at the top and then some looky-likey women. And that diversity point, so back to, in fact, your introduction at the beginning, it has so many nuances. Businesses that just have mini-me's tend not to thrive. Businesses that encourage diversity, it's almost like you should be going, you're not, too many people go, you know I'm really good at my job, so if I find someone to be not my number two who's exactly like me, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
And actually you want to do the opposite.
And then we all say the 2 words, Northern Rock, group thing.
Yes.
But the other interesting thing as well, though, about Mediacom, which is everyone talks about, you know, we're in a transitional stage and it's all about digital and da-da-da-da. Last week was the retirement party of someone who's been at Mediacom for 40 years.
Yeah.
So he is an older, yeah. Fabulous chat.
And we do, actually, we've been fighting to not let him go, actually.
Yeah, because he, frankly, just had enough. Yeah. But, you know, it's that whole thing about,
plans.
It's not about all being 28 and, you know, digital natives, et cetera, and talking about whatever. You need that blend of people who've got a bit more experience, because the other thing as well is it's that institutional memory and the qualities that they bring. So pretty much with this lovely man, Neil, if ever there was a crisis, Neil's attitude was, yeah, that happened about, what, 11 years ago, and this is what we did, and it was all just fine. Whereas everyone else was going, oh, my God, it's all going to end. The client hates us. And he was so brilliant because he'd been there, done that, knew it all. The clients loved him. Everyone trusted him. And it's that diversity thing of going, yeah, we can have a man of 60 working here.
I feel we should declare Neil's
age. No, I know, but, you know, 60 working in a company, working in a business, which is ostensibly about youth and change and what have you. And so,
and he's great at managing.
And he's great at managing change. So, yeah.
Okay, so I think we have time for just one more question. And I'm going to go in the center, the very last row. Not the last row, the hand.
You. Yeah. Yeah, you.
Yes, it's you. You're, yeah. Yes.
You're the one.
You're the one.
It's like I'm a celebrity. Have I finally been chosen? Thank you so much. So.
Hello, I'm Caitlin. I'm a strategy consultant, and I just had my first promotion. Thanks, LSE degree. I just wanted to come back on the point about if you're having guys making banter around you. I think one of the most effective ways I've found is if you banter back, but also call out the sexism at the same time. So, for instance, you could say something like, oh, you know, if you call me out on my gender again, I'm going to menstruate in your mouth, or something. Something shocking that really makes them think about it. Or something, if you want to go less gross, you could say, what's the date? I'm going to write that one down, you know, and sort of shame them a little bit, but still make it a joke. Thanks for your talk. My question is, we've spoken about gender, but I think we also need to speak about sex. And I found over the last few years of my career that it comes up a lot. So for instance, I was at a networking event early on in my career, and I was speaking to someone, and we were bonding over being LSE alumni and how we used to have naps in the Seligman Library, which is really great. If anyone studies here, you should do it. He was a senior exec at a company I would have loved to have worked for, and then a young man who was in the networking circle said, oh, so you slept together then? And it just killed the conversation. He didn't reply to my email. Another instance is, you know, having a mentor who then you think is going really well with, a male mentor, and then solicits you for sex. Or being on an interview panel and there being a senior executive who is interviewing candidates that could potentially work at their company, and a objectively very attractive woman is the final candidate, and I witnessed the man ask her questions that he didn't ask any of the others about her specifically working at his company. My question really is this a problem? Or would you suggest through your research that this is something we should be exploiting? For instance, wearing makeup, making ourselves look sexy, or should we make ourselves unsexy and maybe castrate men? So I would love to know what you think on that point.
Can I just say the thing about making yourself look sexy? Sexy to whom? Because my version of sexy might not be Sue's version of sexy, so it's that whole thing about... Do you mean sexualized? No. Not unless you want to be objectified.
So that doesn't work?
Yeah.
So that's very short-term, and it doesn't work, and our advice, black and white, is don't do that.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of sex in the office, we do have a chapter that has two stories about sex in the office. Because certainly it's in our trouble chapter, and you know, our view is trouble troubles women in a different way to how it troubles men. So that one of the pieces of advice in the book is from a chap who used to work at an organisation, and he says it was fairly clearly a good thing for the man managing director to sleep with as many of the women in the office as possible, and clearly a very bad thing for the senior woman in the organisation, and they weren't that senior in that particular organisation, to not, you know, for her to be trashed if she was known to be sleeping with people. Is that fair? Probably not. Is it still true? Probably to a greater extent than it should be. I think the issue about people passing accusations is, well, first of all, if you have slept with somebody and you can deny it. Secondly, if you have slept with somebody and you can't deny it, declare it. So go, have you heard what happened to me, Catherine? And just you bring it out so it doesn't get used against you. Just don't do it if you can avoid it. And if it's being used in a way that either patronises you or objectifies you, which is what that sounds like, then call that out. Don't allow that. Is that covered? Sex?
Yeah. Thank you for bringing it up.
But thanks for the tip about sleeping in the... now I know. I must get a pass and come and sleep in the library when it's when I get the chance. Yeah, good place to have a kit. Normally I just go to the cinema, but only when I know it's... Yeah, that's a bad thing. When you go to a preview screen, you fall asleep and it's really bad. And if you go, it's great. Yeah, I loved it.
I love it, especially love that bit.
I love that bit. Oh, brave. Yeah.
So I want to thank Catherine and Sue for their presentation and answering our questions.